Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode, A Blood-Curdling Tale.
Hit it!
And welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members, to another spectacular and most awesome episode of the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. Well, here we are, another week and another podcast. What have I been doing? Well, it's a great question, because you know what? I don't know what I've done this week yet. It's sort of a weird time-traveling experience. What I have been doing is preparing for an upcoming Stars Without Numbers game, which will be happening on the Wednesday in the past of when this episode will air. And you know what? Maybe future Jason will talk about that. I don't know. Maybe future Jason will be hit by a bus and you'll never know. Let's hope not. But I have been continuing to prepare for my eventual Masks of Narlahotep campaign. And taking the advice of Joe Richter, I went and I looked up Runeslinger's YouTube page. I put a link in the show notes for that. And I looked up where he was talking about his take on how he's ran the Masks of Narlahotep campaign. Apparently, this dude's run it like 4 times. Honestly, I find that so strange because it's not the first time that I've heard people running this campaign like multiple times. In fact, the Armchair Keepers of Arcane Secrets, which is another YouTube channel that he talks about during that video, one of the guys in that has also run the campaign multiple times. And on the one hand, I think that's amazing. And on the other hand, I say to myself, wouldn't you want to run something else? Like, what exactly is it that draws you to playing the campaign multiple times? I don't know, you guys let me know what you think about that. Have you run a campaign that you've run like multiple times and it just seems to be that go-to thing? I mean, I've done adventures multiple times, like little adventures from Dungeon Magazine or, you know, one-shots. I'm sure many people have done convention games multiple times, but that's sort of the point of a convention game, right? Is that you're going to do this, you know, over and over to get people into the game, and you kind of need to know what you're doing, kind of massage that thing. But a whole entire campaign that can take years? I don't know, man. That's an interesting concept. Anyway, I'm not trying to throw shade on anybody, just a genuine question, but I'm curious to hear what you guys think about that. And in other news, we've got at least one call here for the Mimic Mailbox. So let's take a dive in. We got a call from Mr. Che Webster.
Hey Weeb, it's Che. I just wanted to call in and thank you for episode, I think it's 7, Take It to the Next Level. A couple of thoughts on learning new big games, and also wanted to comment on your statement about how no game was ever better for having more rules. Oh boy, do I disagree with that statement.
Wait, hold on. Did I actually say that? Rewind, play the tape. I don't think I remember a single game in which the rules themselves made the game a better experience. Busted! I guess I did say that. Let's listen to the rest of what Che has to say.
Yeah, let's deal with that first. I think there have been plenty of games I've run that have had too few rules and have been absolutely awful for it, or put me in a really difficult position. I've had to make something up on the fly and then it's not necessarily worked out, and I've had to go and like fiddle around with it. Yeah, I really appreciate having a solid set of rules, to be honest with you. And even if I don't need to know all of them or use all of them in one go, it's just great to be able to go look up a solution. Which kind of brings me to the question of like how I go about learning new games. So I would say this as a person who has done this in a bad way and lots of good ways. The good way is pretty much start playing with it. When I learned D&D 3rd Edition, for example, we just started playing, made up characters, and keep it simple. Like, if you live in 5th edition, go make some human characters, make some fighters, and make some thieves, and have some fights, run some combats, like you said, kind of learn the basics and then build your knowledge as you need to. So if your players create a character of a certain type, then obviously that's great. And whatever characters they've created, obviously then you can focus your attention on knowing what those characters can do. So learn their abilities, feats, whatever, spells, all that sort of stuff. Just what they have. Don't worry about everything they can possibly do, but just what they have. Get your head around those things. Work with the players on introducing those to your game. Another top tip is to make a cheat sheet. I go actually and start playing with the rules. I'll fight combats on my own and stuff like that. And then I'll make notes of the things that I need to remember. And a big tip, which comes from Justin Alexander of the Alexandrian, is as you prep your adventures and you come across different things, go look up the rule. So, for example, if they're climbing and they might fall, go look up the climbing and the falling rules. If you're picking locks in a bit of an adventure, go look up the picking lock rules. And here's the cool thing. If you are learning the game, add those rules on your adventure notes so that then you can just see them when you get there in the adventure. So, like, if it's a pick lock thing, put the pick lock rules at the bottom of the sheet of paper that has that particular location that you've keyed, and it will just be there for you when you need it. And of course, over time, you can take away those notes when you've memorized things. Final thing is anything you want to learn, repeat it, do it lots. So if you want to learn the combat rules, then run a load of fights, you know, that kind of thing. Whatever rules need to be embedded in your memory, well, I'd go do them a lot. Thanks, Weeb.
So there you have it, folks. Che Webster, Roleplay Rescue, the man with a plan. And honestly, Che, first of all, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And I think those are some excellent pieces of advice. I especially like that you point out, you know, choosing fighters and thieves, because the implication being that they're the least complicated classes to play, right? You don't need to deal with special abilities. You don't need to deal with magic, and you can get right into doing what they do, which is fighting people and stealing their stuff. Depending on the edition, thieves can be a little tricky, but not as tricky as what a wizard is going to be, for instance. So thanks very much again. Also, thanks for the Alexandrian, another great resource for anybody looking to build their GMing skills. I'm going to put a note of that in the show notes so that people can find it. So that's it for the Mimic Mailbox this week, folks. If you have comments, questions, criticisms, things like Che that you don't agree with that I say, which is perfectly fine, man. I welcome dissension. Come on, let's talk about it. You can call me, leave me a message at my SpeakPipe, which is in the show notes, or you can drop me a line at my email, dungeonplunger@gmail.com. We can have a little convo, and, you know, I'll make you famous, all right? So let's move on to the main topic, a blood-curdling tale.
Let's get it on.
Nor is it to be thought that man is either the oldest or the last of the Earth's masters, or that the common bulk of life and substance walks alone. The old ones were, the old ones are, and the old ones shall be. Not in the spaces we know, but between them. They walk serene and primal, undimensioned, and to us unseen. Yogg-Sothoth knows the gate. Yogg-Sothoth is the gate. Yogg-Sothoth is the key and the guardian of the gate. Past, present, future, all are one in Yogg-Sothoth.
Woo! That was spooky, man. That's a little quote from The Dunwich Horror by a dude that some of you might know as H.P. Lovecraft. Howard to the Philip Lovecraft. Man, sounds like a porno name to me. But you know what? It was a pulp author from the 1920s. Pretty famous dude. Well, now he's a famous dude. Back then, nobody knew who he was, and nobody really cared. And yet, this guy is a dude that has left an indelible mark on our society. On the cover of one of these books that I have, it says, One of the most influential practitioners of American horror, H.P. Lovecraft inspired the work of Stephen King, Anne Rice, Clive Barker, and many more as he perfected his mastery of the macabre. His works developed from seminal fragments into acknowledged masterpieces of terror. This volume traces his chilling career. This quote is from The Road to Madness. The first book that I ever actually read of Lovecraft's tales was a little book that was handed to me by a friend, and it was called The Best of H.P. Lovecraft, Blood-Curdling Tales of the Horror and the Macabre. Jason back then did not know how to say macabre. I think I said macabre. I don't know. Honestly, I don't remember. All I know is I probably said it wrong. In fact, if you've ever read Lovecraft, there's probably like a megaton of words in here that you have no idea what they mean. Nobody talks like this. If somebody ever came up to you and started talking to you like this, you might want to recommend them getting psychiatric help. That's not exactly what I wanted to talk about today. What I wanted to talk about was my introduction to Lovecraft and Call of Cthulhu. Inspired by listening to Runeslinger talking about him running Masks of Narlahotep. And, you know, I said, hey, maybe I should share my story. It began on a cold and stormy night in 1992. I don't know if it was 1992, but what I can tell you is my introduction to Lovecraft and Call of Cthulhu was a strange and winding tale, one strangely fitting yet appropriate to the genre. It began like many things do. Back when I was a teenager, I lived in this tiny little town that was 20 minutes outside Winnipeg, a place where prairie grasses grow so high that if you walked in a field, you'd be swallowed up in an instant, possibly never to be seen again. You know, there's the jokes about living out on the prairies, that you can see your dog run away for 2 weeks. And they're not wrong, it's flat. One time when we went on a family trip, one of my brother-in-laws came along with us, and the flatlands completely freaked him out. And I'm not even joking. He was, I guess, whatever the opposite of agoraphobic is. I don't know, but I kind of found that amusing. Growing up, I had a small group of friends. You know, we'd being out in the country, we'd shoot our pellet guns in the backyard at targets, and, you know, sometimes we'd shoot at things that we weren't supposed to shoot at. Often, we'd ride our bikes through the monkey trails, the weaving and wild woodlands near the river. I never knew why they called them monkey trails, but that's what they called them. Basically, hiking, biking, whatever. I guess, you know, that was the place where you went to monkey around, I guess, if I had to guess. When we weren't up to doing no good, whatever that was, a couple of us would go and watch movies and talk about movies, and especially horror movies. My favorite horror movie franchise of all time was the Nightmare on Elm Street series. I loved Freddy Krueger. I loved how hilarious he was. And I thought that his hand razor glove was like the coolest weapon that there ever was. Oh, I remember going out for Halloween as Freddy Krueger. And I just felt like, you know, Jason Voorhees, that is, and Michael Myers from Halloween were just kind of boring. I mean, they just went around and killed people. I mean, even the Leprechaun was pretty awesome. I mean, he came up with some pretty fancy ways of killing people. And I feel like kind of in a lot of ways, that's what a lot of those slasher films were. They were an effort to come up with creative ways of killing half-naked teenagers and, you know, giving you a little bit of a fright, kind of like going down on a roller coaster, that thrill of being safe and yet scared at the same time. One day, I discovered this glossy flyer offering 10 VHS movies for a penny, and all you had to do was buy a bunch of movies later, and that was it. And I was hooked. I was working for my dad at the time. I was cleaning his warehouse. Later on, I would move on to move furniture, And for a teenager, I made pretty decent money at the time. One of the movies that I ended up getting at the time was The Army of Darkness. Man, that is like one of my favorite movies of all time. And it has always stuck with me. I remember the, "My name is Ash, and I'm a slave. As far as I can figure, the year is 1300 AD, and I'm being dragged to my death. It wasn't always like this. I had a real life once. A job. I had a wonderful girlfriend, Linda. Together, we drove to a small cabin in the mountains. It seemed an archaeologist had come to this remote place to translate and study his latest find, the Necronomicon Ex Mortis, the Book of the Dead. Bound in human flesh and inked in blood, this ancient Sumerian text contained bizarre burial rites, funeral incantations, and demon resurrection passages. It was never meant for the world of the living. The book awoke something dark in the woods, something evil. It took Linda, then it came after me. It got into my hand and it went bad, so I lopped it off at the wrist. But that didn't stop it. It came back big time." Like, that's how the movie starts. I think what I really loved about it was this combination of sort of the future guy in the fantasy world. And I've always wanted to kind of do that. Do a campaign, or at least a little mini campaign of a couple of adventurers from the modern world sucked back into the medieval past with maybe a little bit of magic, fighting undead with shotguns and all that kind of stuff. Later on, I would find out that the Army of Darkness was based off of the Evil Dead 1 and 2. Much, much later on, they would make an Evil Dead TV series and a couple of movies that were actually pretty decent in the fact that they were quite horrific versus the horror comedy of the Evil Dead movies. Back to the time when I'm a teenager, much after this, I would go on a family vacation to the west coast of Canada. I'm in this little cramped bookstore in some Vancouver City mall, and I found it there, sitting amongst other books, the Necronomicon, waiting, calling to me. The book was a little black paperback with some elaborate pentacle design on it, and it was written by this dude named Simon. No last name, just Simon. Who was Simon? Where did he find this? Where did he translate it from? Is Simon insane? Well, Simon said, "Buy this book." And that's what I did. The Necronomicon was real. I remember poring over this little book, too naive to understand that this wasn't some translation of a real ancient text. I thought it was real. I thought this was a real book and, you know, that somebody had actually translated this. I was such an idiot. Anyway, I proudly kept that little book on my meager bookshelf, along with my Hardy Boy collection and a whole bunch of beat up Star Wars novels. Because you know what? I was a rebel. And somehow having some sort of weird satanic pentacled book in my bookshelf made me a badass. I don't know what I was thinking. Later, I moved to Montreal a few years after that. And there, I attended my first Western Civ class in college. The teacher began to talk about Sumer and the Cradle of Civilization. And bingo bango, a connection was made. I excitedly raised my hand. "Hey, have you ever heard about this book called the Necronomicon?" I asked. She had not. Thankfully, nobody in that class knew what I was talking about. I still to this day am completely embarrassed that I was asking a Western Civ professor about if the Necronomicon was real and all of that. Anyway, not long after, I joined the college gaming club called The Guild, and I was chasing girls. The Guild was a magical place. It was this tiny little office space, big enough for a desk, a two small cedar couch, and a couple of chairs. There was basically this little small cubbyhole that could be locked up, and it had a small stash of RPG books that were kept inside of it, locked up and safe. And among those books was the 5th edition version of Call of Cthulhu. This was when I finally learned that the Necronomicon was a fake book created by some old dude writer, and they made an RPG based on one of his more famous stories. Sometimes I wondered myself, why did they name the RPG the Call of Cthulhu? Like, why did they choose that specific name? I'm sure that it's out there somewhere, and I'm just too lazy to figure it out. I mean, imagine if the game would have been called, like, The Dunwich Horror, or The Whisperer in Darkness, or The Haunter of the Dark. In the end, The Call of Cthulhu seems like an apropos name. Despite being in the gaming club, I did very little role-playing. Mostly, I played Magic and cut classes. I ended up dropping out of college because, well, the fact of the matter is I was just way too cool for school. I ended up joining the Canadian Armed Forces in the reserves, and I was there for a very brief period of time. And then I left Montreal and I moved out and I went back on my own to Winnipeg. Eventually, after a few months there, I decided to move back to Montreal to my family. But then something interesting happened. Almost as if it was straight out of a Call of Cthulhu scenario. Someone died. The deceased in question was the father of a friend of mine who had died of cancer unexpectedly at quite a young age. I was still too young to question my own mortality. While attending the viewing with a bunch of us from college gathered together, huddled, talking quietly as family and friends went about doing what they do at such somber occasions, was when a friend of ours said, "Hey, I've been reading this scenario called Escape from Innsmouth. It's for the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game." I was vaguely aware of Call of Cthulhu. I understood that it was a game, but I had never played it. I didn't really know what the expectations were. And this invitation would be the very beginning of my real role-playing career. Could you call it a career? Hobby? Obsession? Anyway, we gathered in his home in the basement of his parents' home, as so many young people have done in ages past, carrying on that grand tradition of eating chips, pizza, and hot wings while creating characters and to delve into an imagination that was rearing its head to be released. I created my first investigator, a photojournalist named Jim Dixon. At this point, it would be apropos to cue the Beavis and Butthead laughter. He said dick. Despite Jim's profession as a photojournalist, Jim, in the end, would never actually end up taking a single photo. And when I think about how hilarious that was, I kind of came to the realization that nobody would have taken my character seriously if I would have taken pictures of some of these things, and so I just never bothered doing it. In retrospect, I probably should have taken the pictures and just gone with the flow of things, but I wasn't the brightest bulb. As we delved into the scenario, our characters investigated that decrepit, haunted town of Innsmouth, and eventually my wife would join us. And she created this character who was a daughter of a gangster, and she carried two violin cases with Tommy guns in them. We should have known that things were about to go very, very wrong at that point. During our investigation in Innsmouth, our characters were breaking into a place gathering clues, as Call of Cthulhu investigators are apt to do. And Jim Dixon was keeping six, along with Megan Malone, the gangster's daughter. That was when a bunch of redneck creeps showed up and, essentially working for the police, deputized, decided that, you know what, these investigators needed to be shown the door. So they started beating the crap out of Jim, and Jim was caught talking about how, well, more like screaming about his constitutional rights, and that was when Megan popped out those Tommy guns, gunned them down, and we had the entire town come down on us as we tried to escape from the little village. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, folks, but Jim did not escape from Innsmouth. I know that Chaosium plans to release the new Innsmouth book for 7e, and I'm really hoping that it has this campaign in it. It was the first campaign of any RPG that I had ever played, and it holds a special place in my heart. So many good memories. Whenever I think about it, I just remember good times and a joy at being introduced to a hobby that would take over my life for the next 20 years. And so that's my introduction to Lovecraft and Call of Cthulhu. From a horror comedy to something that still enchants me these 30 years later, I can't deny that the Necronomicon and Army of Darkness has had a huge impact on my life. I still play Call of Cthulhu, and I'm looking forward to launching the Masks of Nyarlathotep and hopefully enchanting a whole new group of people to the world of Call of Cthulhu. Anyway, folks, that's all I have for this week. But let me ask you a question. What was your introduction to Lovecraft or Call of Cthulhu? Let me know. I just wanted to thank everybody who listens to my podcast. Without you guys, I don't know if I would continue to do this, but I know that you're listening and I really appreciate it. I thank Che very much for calling in, and it would be really nice if you guys could review the podcast on Spotify or Apple and like and comment on YouTube. For example, be like Primal Nut, who left this 5-star review. Fun and plungy. Jason is genuinely funny and has great insights on being a dungeon master. I'm really looking forward to where he goes in the future. Be like Primal Nut. Leave the review. Leave the 5 stars. Be the hero that you know that you are deep down inside. Music by Alexander Kizanaku. Cover art by John McNally, the most righteous and best artist dude from the Pacific Northwest. You can call in and leave a message at www.speakpipe.com/thedungeonplunger, or you can send me an email at dungeonplunger@gmail.com. And remember, when you're plunging into the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets, because they're a pain in the butt. And to all of my Canadian friends, elbows up!